So the title of my talk today is And Yet, And Yet. So there's a haiku by Issa, Japanese poet. The world of dew is the world of dew, and yet, and yet. So Issa was a Japanese priest, Zen priest, and poet and philosopher, and he had a very difficult life. So he had a lot of challenges with his stepmother and spent a lot of his life wandering around Japan as a Zen priest and a poet. And then when he was 51, he went back to his village and had a kind of reconciliation with his stepmother. And he married a woman much younger than him. And they had three children, but all children died within a year of their birth. So I think two of them died after the birth, and one lived for nearly a year and then died as well. And apparently this poem was written after the death of his son. So the world of dew is the world of dew, and yet, and yet. And as a Zen priest, he would have been very familiar with impermanence, what sometimes is called in Buddhism, the three marks of existence. So there's anicca, which is impermanence, so everything passes away. And then dukkha, which is suffering or dissatisfaction, or even just knowing that, you know, even if you're happy now, that's not going to last. There will be changes in your circumstances. And then, of course, anatta, which is no self. And a drop of dew is a very evocative image of impermanence. So, you know, if we go outside early in the morning and we see little drops of dew sparkling in the grass or on spider webs or on the veggies, but we know that, you know, as soon as the sun comes out, they will be gone. So it's a really beautiful symbol of impermanence. And the Buddha had something he called the five remembrances. And basically these were to encourage us to remember the truth of change and to develop some peacefulness with this truth. And so these five remembrances are: I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to experience illness. I have not gone beyond illness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, shall one day be parted from me, shall one day be gone. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions, abide supported by my actions. Whatever action I shall do, of that action I shall be the heir. And so in Buddhism, we have an understanding that whenever we try to make something solid out of the flow of life, it becomes frozen. But then there's also that and yet. When I'm working as a therapist with people who've experienced trauma, that comes up often. So Peter Levine, who is a trauma specialist, he talks about pendulation. So there's this sort of shifting back and forth between the present state and what's happening in life now, and, you know, some of the good things that are happening there as well. And then also having to go back to some of the past, perhaps the traumatic events, which weren't processed fully at the time, often because of the circumstances. And so this is constant pendulating back between life as it is now and then life as it was in the past. And so it's very much that sense of, you know, you're not just living in the past, but the past still informs what's happening now. But it's also being aware of the, you know, things that are going well in life. But sometimes there's a tendency for people to say, oh, you know, but your life is so good now. So let's say someone has had trauma and they, you know, really struggled, but then they managed to get a job and get married and have a lovely family. And so it's like, oh yeah, but your life is good now. Or sometimes it's like, oh, if you go back to the past all the time, you're just living in this victimhood all the time. And you know, you're sort of defined by that, and that neither of them are correct. It's like, yes, life might be okay now, and yet there's also the past that's still influencing my life, or the past was really terrible, and yet I have also got resources and inner strengths, and that are informing my life now. So they're both true. We don't have to be stuck in the past, but we're also not just about the present moment. And I think another area where I see this a lot is in the, working in Aboriginal health, and also the current debate around the voice. And again, it's often a little bit of either or, So it's either a sense of saying First Nations people are victims, and they suffered a lot, and so they're all victims. And a lot of First Nations people are saying, yes, we have suffered, but we don't want to just be seen as our deficits. So in health, there's the gap between the health outcomes for First Nations people and other Australians. And so there's quite a big gap. There's still a 10-year gap in life expectancy, and huge gaps in terms of diabetes, heart disease, and things. But sometimes just looking at those statistics becomes very deficit-based. And Aboriginal people have told me, and have told government, we also want to be recognised for our strength and our resilience. We don't want to just be these figures, these terrible statistics. But on the other hand, just to say, well, we are all Australians and we're all equal, and we don't want anyone to be different or special or have two races in Australia. That's also disregarding the reality of, first of all, the atrocities that have happened, and 65,000 year plus history, which is enormous length of time. And so again, in that debate, it can become very polarized, but it's, and yet, things have happened, and yet there are strengths. We are all equal, and yet there is a different, story for First Nations people in Australia. And I guess there's a certain amount of emotional maturity to be able to hold both those positions at the same time. As Buddhist practitioners, whenever we get into a state where we are denying pain or grieved caused by our attachments to those we love, we fall into the danger of what's called spiritual bypassing. And so this term was first coined by John Velvet, who's part of our sutra readings as well, and who Jeff Dawson often talks about. But he wrote a book called Towards the Psychology of Awakening. And he basically defined spiritual bypassing as a tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. And so we can use our spiritual practice as a defense mechanism to protect us from emotions that we feel uncomfortable with. And some of those emotions are very human emotions of attachment to people that we love, and grief when something happens to those people, or also our vulnerabilities. There's all kinds of emotions, anger, often as we are Buddhists, and we may be uncomfortable with anger, so we think it's much nicer to just sit there and meditate with a smile on our face. But yeah, all of those things, again, there's a certain amount of truth, like we do want to develop a certain amount of equanimity. We don't want to just be, feeling all those emotions all the time and not have this other perspective. So again, it's this and yet, this equanimity, and yet we are also human beings and we have emotions. And in the Brahma Vihara, so one of the Brahma Viharas, which are four qualities that the Buddha recommended to everyone, is equanimity or upekkha. And the Buddha talked about the far enemy of those qualities, and so the exact opposite. So the exact opposite of equanimity is this emotional overreaction and having very poor relationship boundaries and basically being emotionally all over the place. But the near enemy, he talks about qualities that look like the quality but are actually not quite the same thing. And so the near enemy of equanimity can be emotional dissociation, or what he calls distant impartiality. So it's a sort of sense of bit of coldness, emotional coldness. Feeling like, oh, I'm above all of those, human human mess and human chaos, and I'm just sort of floating serenely above it all. But that's actually a near enemy of true equanimity. That's not actually what true equanimity is about. And so whenever we get into this either-or mindset, there's a tendency to become puritanical. So we try and live our lives in a very puritanical way or very perfectionistic. You know, we're always aiming for perfection. And yet we are striving towards that, and yet we are also human beings, and we get caught up as any other human being in emotions as well. And so one of the things about things like Zen practice and psychotherapy, poetry, and any of the arts really, is that ability to be in that space of and yet, and to have the emotional and maturity to be able to hold different perspectives and different realities at the same time, and not have to try and get some sort of solution or some sort of clarity and just, that either or, but being able to be comfortable with the and yet. And this is sometimes a sense of sadness, but also a great humanity in this and yet. It's a reminder of the fleeting nature of life, but also of our common humanity, which can't be excluded from our spiritual awareness and growth. And many of Issa's poems are about nature, so it's always coming back down to earth and coming back down to nature. And so another one of his haikus was, "On a branch, floating downriver, a cricket singing."